has had a negative impact on their mental health, which is up from 32% in early March. About 1 in 5, 19%, say that it has had a major impact, including about 1/4 of women, Hispanic adults, and Black adults. An increasing share of the public report worrying about the economic impacts that coronavirus may have on their lives, with more than half now reporting being worried that their investments will be negatively impacted for the long term, that they will be laid off or lose their job, and nearly half worried that they will lose income due to workplace closure or reduced hours. And while Americans increasingly worry about the impact on their own incomes, about half, actually a little more than half, continue to be worried that they or a family member will get sick from the coronavirus. All this is from a recent Kaiser Family Foundation study, and it shows that the concern about this virus is widespread. There's no evidence that suicides will rise dramatically, let alone surpass potential coronavirus deaths. But historically, in a crisis, suicides tend to diminish as society pulls together for a common purpose. But there is increased demand for services, and the Boston Good Samaritans call center usually receives 250 to 275 calls a day since the start of social distancing to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That number has jumped to about 350 calls a day. Meanwhile, text message conversations are on pace to top 1,000 this month, which would be a record high for the Good Samaritans in Boston. Financial stress, of course, often exacerbates mental health concerns. And last week's jobs numbers showed that 10 million Americans have applied for unemployment assistance in the last 6 million in the last month. 6 million of those 10 million applied last week. Those figures shattered the previous records that were set in 1982. So what are we doing? The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has been a key partner in pushing forward my bill, H.R. 4194, the National Suicide Hotline Designation Act. We're pushing to get this bill that will make 988 the hotline that everybody knows they can call in a mental health emergency and provide more funding for the suicide prevention lifeline included in any fourth coronavirus package to support Americans' access to mental health. I mean, this will literally save lives the day it is put into action, because you shouldn't wake up in the middle of the night and have to find a phone book to know who to call if your house is burning down. We know it's 911. Likewise, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you have a mental health emergency, or your partner or friend has a mental health emergency, you should just know you call 988. So that's where we want to be. And I'm so delighted to be joined today by Dr. Christine Moutier. Dr. Christine Moutier is the chief medical officer at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. A psychiatrist and a strong advocate for suicide prevention herself, it's through her passion and commitment to the work that we see a lasting impact on mental health via research, education, and support to communities across the U.S. You may have also seen her on TV talking about the importance of mental health care. Dr. Moutier, I turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Congressman Seth Moulton. We are really excited to be partnering with you in this important message today to your constituency and anyone else who may be tuning in at this point. So, my thoughts are really that people are struggling across the board in many different ways right now. And this coronavirus pandemic does not mean the exact same thing for each one of us. And yet, on a global scale, all of our lives are being impacted in various ways. And I guess I would like to start with 2 points. That as human beings, we have an incredible resiliency, a human spirit of survival and adaptation and resilience that is part and parcel to how we are wired up. And yet we also have our health, both physical and mental health. And let alone during this period of COVID, on a normal time in America, 1 in 4 Americans is living with a mental health condition. And so now you layer on top of that the stress of worrying about potentially contracting the illness, worrying about your loved ones, the financial potential fallout, and the way that our daily lives have been sort of disrupted, if you will, working remotely, learning remotely or being laid off or finding yourself more alone. And so, you know, all of that, I think this conversation is so important to have. And I thank you, Seth, for the ways that you have made your own experiences of mental health a part of a topic that we should be having around the dinner table and on the Hill, in our workplaces and in our schools. And now is a great time to be having that as well. So thank you again for having me. And I'm excited to delve into kind of how are people doing and what are we seeing and, you know, the advice that we might have to share.
Thanks so much, Christine. You know, we are trying to embrace this just as a team, my congressional team. We have a morning call every single morning where, because we're all working remotely, we all come together and we talk about our work for the day and the latest news and everything. But we've also instituted a 5-minute or so meditative moment where someone will share something that has helped them get through the past few days. Maybe it's a reading from their faith tradition, from scripture or something. Maybe it's a meditation strategy. Maybe it's just a great quote that they find inspiring. We've tried to really put this into practice, but, you know, I hear from people all the time, many of my constituents and whatnot, who are feeling a lot of the stress that we share on our team, the uncertainty about what's going on in the world right now, the fact that our lives have all been upended. So tell me just from a clinical perspective, I mean, you're the PhD here. Tell me from a clinical perspective, what exactly are people experiencing with all this uncertainty?
Right. Well, and you just said it, you know, the first thing is the level of uncertainty is probably more extreme and more prolonged and affecting more of us all at the same time. And, you know, human beings don't do so well with uncertainty. We like to plan, feel a sense of control, and like we know what's coming next. Some of it may be an illusion that we convince ourselves of on a normal, regular basis. But right now, you know, there's no illusion of that. We're all having to face these big questions of how long will this go on? How many people will be affected, how many people will die. It's a very serious time. So that level of uncertainty creates anxiety. And again, that will affect people in different ways. For some people who already have an anxiety disorder, you know, on the one hand, they have practice at dealing with uncertainty or dealing with triggers for their personal, the way that their anxiety disorder plays out for them. So that in some ways gives people with a longer lasting experience of mental health conditions a leg up in terms of knowing what works for them and how it works for them.
So tell me.
On the other hand, they could be triggered into having worsened symptoms for sure at a time like this.
So Christine, I totally get the routine point. I mean, I like routines. My 18-month-old daughter very much likes routines in her life. And this is a truly amazing amount of uncertainty. I mean, I'm in the federal government, and we don't know for sure what's going to happen next week. But to follow up on your point about how this affects different people in different ways, how do you think that this affects especially vulnerable populations? So for older Americans isolated at home, LGBT youth who may not feel safe at home, how does this pandemic impact them?
Yeah, I think thank you for honing right in on that. What we're seeing, for example, at a colleague organization of ours, the Crisis Text Line, is that not only is their volume up right now and the level of anxiety is the biggest concern that's coming forward, but it is among, exactly as you're pointing out, those groups of people who are already marginalized in some way or have trouble accessing healthcare at baseline or who do not have the robust social networks that others have, that this period can affect them even more. It's a time when those of us who are more fortunate must be thinking of those individuals and how we can reach out to those who are elderly, more isolated, people who may be feeling unsafe to even just provide encouragement and support. Those social media campaigns out there that are going on for all of those populations, also for healthcare workers, those are all ways for us to actually rise above as a society and as a community and support each other.
You know, there's this amazing organization in downtown Salem, Massachusetts here that provides support for LGBT youth. And it's striking to go there and talk with some of these amazing kids who don't actually feel safe in their own homes. And they go there after school because it's a safe space. They can get a little bit of a break from their parents. And to imagine being in their shoes now where they have to stay home and they can't see their friends, they can't go to school. It's a lot, it's a totally different world than for someone like me who, frankly, you know, this is the one silver lining of this whole thing is that I get to stay home and see my daughter every day, whereas often I have to be in Washington. So, you know, the quarantine's not good for anybody. No one likes it, but it's truly tragic for some people out there. Now, I want to turn the conversation a second to the trauma. As many of you know, who've followed me at all, last June I disclosed publicly that I dealt with post-traumatic stress coming out of the Iraq War. And I told the story of one of the things that haunts me from that war, one of a few things, but it was when I was on the road to Baghdad and our column was advancing north and we came across a car that had been heading south and the Marines just ahead of me thought that it was Saddam's special forces who were reported by intelligence to be attacking us and had been. But it turned out this car was a family, and they'd been shot up. The mother and father were clearly dead, but there was a boy about 5 years old lying still alive on the road. And there's nothing I wanted to do more at that moment when our armored vehicle came across that boy than to stop and get out and hold him in my arms and do whatever I could to try to save his life. At that moment, I made one of the toughest decisions I've ever made in my life, which was to keep going. I knew that to stop my vehicle would stop the entire battalion and put hundreds of Marines' lives at risk. I also knew as a practical matter that there were more advanced medical personnel following close behind. But at a personal level, it was just unbelievably hard to leave that boy lying there. And that's something that I've thought about a lot. And his image is something I know that I'll have in my mind till the day that I die. That's one of the things that haunted me from Iraq. And you can imagine how some of the doctors and nurses going through this pandemic are going to be haunted by some of the images of patients that they lose, that they're unable to help, that have family who can't even come and see them in their dying moments. But all of us are going to just find that there are parts of this experience of this pandemic that may be traumatic in one way or another. One of the hardest things for me about this whole experience was I came back from the war and I didn't have very bad symptoms. I wasn't suicidal. I wasn't worried about driving down the road thinking that a bomb would blow up. I knew a lot of veterans who were having experiences like that. I had bad dreams. I would wake up in cold sweats sometimes. I wasn't able to always focus on my work. But it took me a long time to accept the fact that I had post-traumatic stress as well. It wasn't until I was actually talking to a Harvard professor in grad school and describing some of these experiences that he looked at me and he said, you know, Seth, you really should talk to someone. You should get some help. And he convinced me to do it. And I can't tell you how much that help has changed my life and made a huge difference in my life and the lives of those around me. And it took a bit of courage to just admit to myself that I had a problem. Maybe it wasn't as bad as some other veterans, but I needed to deal with it too. And so that experience, I think, has given me perhaps a little bit of a window into what might be coming for some of us in this pandemic who will literally have post-traumatic stress coming out of this. And I've heard this from a lot of hospital personnel and executives that we absolutely expect there to be post-traumatic stress coming out of this pandemic. So how can we have this conversation? How can we support those individuals who are in these traumatizing situations? And And what can people do to build resilience and take care of their mental health during this crisis, knowing that there's a lot of bad news out there, but it could get worse before it gets better?
Yeah, and thank you so much for sharing about that. I do think that trauma, whether it's, I call it big T trauma or smaller T trauma, there's a human response that is completely normal and expected that, as you described, is everything from having your emotions change, feeling a sense of hypervigilance, being startled more easily, having your just general level of irritability being just, you know, kind of wound up tighter, and losing your temper more easily, having your sleep disrupted. Those are all very normal, expected human responses to trauma. And, you know, when we think about what's happening right now, yes, definitely the healthcare workers and first responders may be at risk of developing some of this, especially if they're frontline. But it's other people, too, for whom, you know, either just genetically or earlier experience-wise, they're already vulnerable to just one more traumatic experience to kind of push things physiologically up, as you might have experienced that. Post-traumatic stress is a very physical experience. It is not just something that's happening in terms of feelings or thoughts. It's throughout your entire body. So I really think the first thing that's so important is to just recognize that we are going through this, and those around us are going through this during this time. And we can expect some responses that, again, there's not a need to turn it into pathology, but if it's interfering with your life or making you so irritable that it's interfering with your relationships, those are the things that are signals to say, let's do something about it. And how do we be resilient and protect ourselves? I think number one, it's compassion for ourselves and to say, it is okay to be human right now. In fact, it's more than okay. It's a fact. And so, you know, let's embrace it. Now, what am I going through? And have just an open mind rather than feeling like you have to cover it up. If there's someone trustworthy in your life, you can talk to them about it. Certainly seeing a therapist or another mental health professional would be recommended. But even if you're not ready for that yet, things like writing it down and finding ways to process it, even on your own, can be actually protective in terms of how that impact settles in into your physiology. Seth, I, if you don't mind, I would love to kind of ask you a little bit more about your experience, because I really think it could be helpful for people. Sure. You know, the world has been changing so much around the stigma of mental health experiences, and you being open and sharing about that human experience of what you, you know, how your wartime experiences then later affected you, I think is just a way that people can wrap their heads around this more and come to terms with maybe needing some help at some point themselves, that it's not a sign of weakness. I mean, what was the experience like for you? Have you faced stigma? How has it been on the Hill? You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I suppose.
Sure. Thanks for asking it, Christine. You know, one of the first things was just coming to terms with exactly what you just described, which is that this is a normal human reaction. And actually, one of the most powerful statements made to me about this was not from a therapist, although a great therapist. It was from just a fellow Marine who, frankly, dealt with this his own post-traumatic stress before me. And he said, you know, Seth, I call it post-traumatic stress, not post-traumatic stress disorder, because after what we saw, it would be a disorder if you weren't affected by it. In other words, it is totally natural. It's totally human to be affected by traumatic experiences. There's an evolutionary reason why we have these kinds of responses. So coming to terms with the fact that this isn't just a disease or a sickness or something like this. This is normal, and you just have to take care of yourself. Get that mind in shape, just like you get the rest of your body in shape. That was a big, I think, victory for me in just sort of understanding and feeling comfortable with this. But the decision to share it publicly where I'm a public figure was another story entirely. And I had started seeing a therapist a few years before I ran for Congress. And when I ran for Congress for the first time in 2014, I told a few people about this on my team, but basically that was it. I didn't even tell my whole team. We did everything we could to keep it hidden because we thought it would be a huge political liability. And this past year, when I ran for president, I figured that this would be a political liability again, but I also said, you know what, if I'm running for the top leadership position in the country, I ought to lead by example. And there are a lot of people out there who need to hear this story. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to tell it. I'm going to tell it on my own terms. And frankly, I'm going to get it out there before someone just discovers it because they're trying to dig up something on me. And so I was nervous that first, I'll never forget the night that I told this story for the first time in public. I had no idea how it would go. There are plenty of stories from our political past of leaders who have been immediately exiled from the political process by sharing that they have mental health issues that they're dealing with themselves. The presumptive vice president in the late 1970s, Eagleton, was removed from the ticket when it was discovered that he had sought help for mental health. But I can't tell you how different the reaction has been. It's been unbelievable. I mean, the amount of support, the respect people have given me for talking about this, the number of people, veterans and non-veterans, who've reached out to me from all over the country to say, thank you for sharing this story because I have a mental health issue as well. And I mean, people come up to me all the time, just on the street, friends that I've known for years, decades even, who for the first time have said, you know what, Seth, I go to therapy too. And I've never told you this, but I see someone because it helps. It's been extraordinarily eye-opening, relieving, in the sense that I don't have to keep the secret to myself anymore, and really gratifying because I can see that it makes a difference in the lives of other people who know me to have shared this story.
It's so wonderful to hear that. And that, I have to say, is more of the norm these days. I mean, I'm sure there are still pockets of, you know, in our nation where you know, things are still in the shadows. You know, I just want to encourage anyone who is watching and listening to Seth's story that what we see happening in our network from the national level of the mental health and suicide prevention world is that people are coming out with their own stories of either loss or lived experience, we call it. Lived experience meaning anything from a mental health condition to having survived your own suicide attempt to supporting a loved one who's going through a struggle or a mental health condition. And these people and the storytelling that's happening, I think, is leading the way for advocacy and change related to mental health and suicide prevention in our nation. That combined with it's the right moment in the scientific world as well, where we know so much more about the brain, about neuroscience, about mental health conditions, and about suicidal struggles, so that there's really no need to buy into those old myths and stigmatizing falsehoods about these experiences. As you said, Seth, these are human experiences. They have always been part of the human condition, and now we're able to understand them through science and share and lean on each other in ways that we never were before. So this is a beautiful time in that sense, and kind of bringing it back to this COVID moment, what we see happening, and I wonder among your constituents and in Massachusetts if it's the same, is that mental health is a topic now related to this infectious disease pandemic. That's the first time ever in history. And I think we're ready to be proactive in a way like never before. So, you know, I wonder if you're seeing some of the same things from your standpoint, Seth, and also how you see people kind of thriving and coping.
I am absolutely seeing that. And there are amazing stories of resilience, especially coming out of our hospitals. There's nurses and doctors who are making do with not enough gear, not enough supplies, and a lot of uncertainty in their daily lives. And yet they do it. They're developing innovations every single day to save people's lives. I was just talking to a doctor who, she's been in the thick of it in a New York ER, and she's been staying in a hotel room in Manhattan for the week that she works, just so that she doesn't go home and infect her kids. And then she finally got to go home, and she's living in isolation in her bedroom, so that she's quarantined from her kids while she's enjoying her week off after working nonstop for 12 days or something like that. And these are heroes in our midst who are making it happen. The volunteers who are working at the soup kitchens and the food pantries, because a lot of people are afraid to volunteer right now and are making sure that people in our community can be fed. And even the business owners who are finding ways to somehow keep their folks employed so that they don't go hungry. These are all stories of humanity and resilience. But there also is obviously a lot of tragedy. And, as I said at the top, we're working hard to get this 988 bill included in the next relief package so that people across the country can really know where to go for help, because there's so much focus on the immediate medical needs right now of fighting this virus that, although you're right, people are connecting the virus and mental health. There's some people, we're not talking about mental health enough. And so I wanted to just turn it back to you, and just with the minute or two we have remaining, Christine, just tell people what do we need to do to get help today, since we can't just dial that 3-digit number yet? And how can we, as friends and neighbors who are sitting here quarantined in our own homes but admiring the work of these frontline nurses and doctors and all the EMTs and first responders and everything who support their work, how do we help them as they're going through these traumatic experiences?
Yeah, thanks, Seth. It is such a surreal moment in that, those of us who have empathy in spades, you almost have a sense of guilt for if you're not on the front line and feel like there's such a disconnection. But, I just want to point out that right now, more so than ever, even though we're calling it social distancing, the truth is we're staying physically distanced because the viral spread is a physical, viral entity. But socially, and I think communally, we are more connected than ever. If you just take any measure of that on social media, on the media, looking at what's happening in neighborhoods, the 7 p.m. New York City clapping and cheering that's going on.
No, you're right. You're right.
We just have such an intense need to connect with each other, and we are doing that. So, don't lose heart. I think remember that by taking care of your own mental health right now, think about those basics of get rest, take breaks from the media, make sure you're staying hydrated, exercise, go easy on the alcohol, and find ways to connect and structure your life a bit. And that's going to allow all of us to come through this even stronger and be able to keep continuing to carry that flag for the issues that we're both so passionate about related to mental health and suicide prevention. Those issues will still be there. We will be there then also to support those frontline healthcare workers and first responders. And together we will be stronger. We have to just keep that as our, sort of our mantra during this time.
We will. And we will get through this, and we'll get through it because we're not perfect, but we're the best nation in the world, and we come from amazing communities that know what it means to support one another, especially in a time of need. And that's exactly what you're seeing manifested in these extraordinary ways going, these extraordinary things happening every single day. So, look, it's a dark time in many ways. It's a tough time in countless ways. And yet I have a lot of optimism. I think that we will in fact be better and stronger coming out of this because we are learning about how important community is and how much we do have to rely on one another. And I hope that is the lasting legacy of this pandemic, as tragic as it is. So in closing, let me just thank Christine, Dr. Moutier. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me remind everybody that the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available. If you or a loved one needs support at any point, it's 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-TALK. Hopefully soon it will simply be 988, but in the meantime, 1-800-273-TALK. Also, check out my website, molten.house.gov, for more mental health resources. Consider making time in your day for that meditative moment, that chance to just check in with yourself and exercise your brain and make sure that you're ready for the traumatic experiences ahead. Because we can all get through this. We can get through it together. We can get through it by relying on one another. And we can get through it by recognizing that we have to take care of ourselves, that we have to make sure that we're in good shape for this and seek help when we need it. That's the right, the human, the natural thing to do. So, Christine, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, everybody, for listening online. Reach out to those resources. Reach out to me if I can be of help, and we'll get through this together. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Seth. Take care. Bye-bye.